Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the tree of life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
What's up, everybody? This is Sugar Steve from Questlove Supreme. As we celebrate the holiday season, this felt like a worthy two-part classic to revisit. Here is Mariah Carey. We recorded this in the middle of the night, but it was worth it. Mariah was promoting her book, and she was an open book to us. This is a really free and fun conversation with one of the biggest superstars of music. Part 2 originally aired on Friday, January 15th, 2021. Enjoy, everybody, and happy holidays and a healthy new year from Team Supreme and everybody at Questlove Supreme.
In terms of editing, how does one, because you definitely walked a mighty tight rope as far as like telling your side of the story and your experiences, but when you're writing your memoir, how do you know what stories to tell and what stories to leave out? Because you said that, you know, oftentimes you're not alone. So oftentimes your stories have happened to happen with people that are with you. So how do you know like what to share and like what's TMI and what's, okay, this part of the story is cool to tell. I feel safe telling the story. I guess what I'm asking is, how did you know how much to share about Sony Prison? How did you know how much to reveal about your Mottola period without fear of further repercussion or litigious action or any of those things?
Well, you know, in America, anybody can be litigious, and I've noticed that. Pray to that. And by the way, if anyone should be litigious, it's me, to get a certain amount of years back of my life that were spent basically, you know, under somebody's control.
Let the church say amen.
Amen. Listen, word.
But seriously, honestly, I there were certain stories we didn't even delve into until like kind of the end of the process. Like the story at the kitchen table with the butter knife and stuff like that. But these are things that actually happen, and whether somebody else, and that you got to look it up to know what I'm talking about, whether somebody else, you know, felt that that was TMI, I don't care. Like, that was part of my story. That was a catalyst to get me the hell out of that situation where you sometimes, you know, a lot of women, whoever it is, I don't want to say it's specifically women, but we tend to tolerate domestic abuse in whatever form that may take for longer than we should be taking it. And that's what I did, because emotional abuse is, I'm not saying it's worse than physical abuse, but it's a form of abuse.
Absolutely.
It's probably even more damaging, you know.
Stays with you.
Yeah, it stays, yeah.
I was going to ask you, you know, being at that period in your life, what do you think led you into a romantic relationship with, you know, the head of your label? And you know, how, like, how did it even get to that point?
Again, I would hope that people will read about this, because I think when you read about it and you understand what my childhood was like, you understand what my early adult, very early adult, well, not even adulthood, late teens, mid to late, like, was about as a struggling singer and songwriter with everything in my head going towards a goal, I'm not going to be like my family members that I've seen go down the path of drug abuse and prostitution and all the things that happen, right? Where a mass appeal audience doesn't even understand what that is. And if it's ever been, you know, used or talked about or spoken about in the media, it's always been like, for shame, look at that. Like, it's never been like, look at what she actually came out
she
of.
She came from, yeah, look at what she escaped. Yeah, it's never viewed as a success story.
No, but it's also like, and I'm trying, and people think I was trying, like, look what I came from. Like, I'm just saying, I'm not saying that's exclusively a Black experience, but it surely ain't a middle of the road, la-di-da-di-da, princess.
It's not an adult contemporary experience.
No, it's not. It's not anything other than a really, really dysfunctional and hard experience that I went through, and multiple times. So when you ask what led to that situation, I didn't have boyfriends like after high school. I never had like a real, an actual serious situation, because when I was growing up, I always knew I'm not going to be around these people. I don't care. Like, I'm getting out of this. Go on. I'm going to realize my dreams. This is not an if, this is a when. And so when I do, I won't be around these people that I'm around right now who are doubters and who look at me as the scum of the earth. That's what I'm not going to. So anyway, in dealing with that relationship and how it evolved, there are many factors that made it evolve. But what I will say is he believed in me as much as I believed in myself. And that is the most attractive quality that I can find. So maybe there were other things where it wasn't like, oh my gosh, it's my schoolgirl crush and la, 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 la. And, you know, knowing that he was 20 plus years older than me and I was a kid, but there's a certain sense of validation and a sense, and at the beginning, I'm saying, and a sense of security when you're having to fight your own family, your own demons, your own stuff. That was there. It was, and that's where they got this whole Prince Charming narrative. But let's face it, it wasn't that, and it certainly didn't evolve into that from a number of reasons that I've talked about a lot. But, you know, it was what it was, and I definitely wish him well. I just wish I could get back some of those years and just insert, like, a party every now and then with a couple girlfriends, or, like, a fun moment, or, like, a phone conversation without somebody having to be like, who are you talking to? What's going on? Yeah. What is it? And freaking out and ruining everything. And taking, like, as much as those years were amazing with the successes and things, in the early years I'm talking about, it was also very much like, well, you can have fun for 10 more minutes and then it's over.
Back to work.
So, wow.
Wait, I don't want to spoiler alert. And again, Mariah is correct. I think probably the best way to, I don't know, not have the experience that I had, but, you know, I recommend that people get this book and take in the information.
Yeah.
So they can learn like I did. But there's one incident I kind of want to ask about, but I feel like it's the most gripping story in the book, so I don't want to spoiler alert it. But I will call it the French fry incident.
What is this you keep talking about?
Okay, I won't say it's the French.
I haven't gotten to it yet. So
she's basically at the height of, well, what is truly the height of Mariah Itis in a 30-year story career? I will say that, yeah, she's way beyond household name here. And just for her to have a simple pleasure, like French fries, winds up turning into a near Will Smith enemy of the state situation with escaping security people and da 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 da. So, and I'm I'm asking you, one time I got to ask Will Smith this question, and mm-hmm. I asked him, like, what is it when you're in this house alone? How many people are here just for you to feel comfortable to be alone, like walk downstairs in your underwear? And he was like, right. Like 17 people.
Jesus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He felt he needed 17 people.
No. Well, because I've never seen an estate that sprawling and big. I mean, it's like 250 acres and, you know, it's like a full scale staff of, you know, it's a full staff at his living quarters.
It's bigger than a ranch. It's the middle of nowhere. Yeah.
And the thing is like, I'm like, well, okay. Like if you get out of bed and want to get some orange juice at 4 a.m, like all these people, your staff is in the house. Like you can't just be yourself and walk down in your underwear. So I'm like, okay, what's the number of minimum people that have to be in this house for you to feel like I'm alone? And he said, 17. Normally there's about 40 plus people on his property, security and all that stuff. So, I mean, during the height of what I call between Mariah Carey and Glitter. How often, even in your home, what was isolation or just a moment to yourself? Like, was it still always with security, no matter where you were, and even in your house? Like, was it always like that?
Okay, so we're speaking specifically about what I'll call Sing Sing, right? Like that.
Yes. She refers to her.
Yes, we get
house. Yes.
because when you say up until Glitter, that's a whole nother thing. Like, because I left at Butterfly during the writing Butterfly.
Well, I was trying to figure out, like, just a
Glitter
time
was
period.
On Virgin.
Yeah. Okay.
But that was a whole nother thing. So when you read the book, you'll see, okay, that was its own hysteria and whole thing. So I'll break it up into the couple years that I lived in that huge mansion,
right.
Which you can Google it. There's really no, we never took any pictures. Like, you know, today everybody would take pictures of their house. Everybody would make a huge deal out of it. It's a $30 million mansion, massive sprawling thing that I, by the way, paid for half of everything down to the electric as a 20-something-year-old woman.
Wow, that man had you splitting bills in your 20s. Boy, Twitter would go crazy.
But I'm saying, but that was me being like, oh, I don't want to be like my mom, and I don't want to be kicked out of my own house. And
right.
little did I know when he said, here's a fabulous piece of property, let's make this a house. I was like, okay, great. I just got $1 million for a publishing advance or whatever it was. So I'm thinking, I don't know how much stuff costs. And I'm like, okay, I need to pay for half of this because I want it to be mine. I never want to be kicked out of my house. And when I said I was going to get married, I believed in that. I was like, oh, I guess this is for the rest of my life. Like, let's just do it and then we'll get out of it whenever. No,
well, you need agency to make it a real relationship. Like, you need agency, your own.
Yes, your own sense of self-worth and everything else that I had worked that hard for to that point. But anyway, at that point, there was always security. When people were coming to the house, like the French Fry incident that you're talking about, the jailbreak incident, as we call it, and the Brat and JP and all of that. I don't know. There were 10 security, armed security guards. There were housekeepers, management, like all those people were there. Did I ever feel like, I used to creep down the stairs sometimes and have like a semi-private moment until I would hear the beep beep on the intercom. What are you doing?
Wow.
And that would freak me out. But it happened,
that's freaking me out.
Happened all the time.
In every room, the intercom was in every room because that's a big house. That's
okay.
So even if you wanted to just get a snack in the refrigerator, like don't eat that.
No, that wasn't said. But it would just be like I would sneak out of the bed and I talk about this, like barely trying to not move the bed, and I would sneak out and tiptoe to the back area of my closet, go that way to the right, and then sneak all the way around the house, you know, down the house, down the side to the where the kitchen was. Meanwhile, I could have gone straight down to the kitchen, but I didn't want to walk through the bedroom, so then went away. And then I would go that way, and I would suddenly get into the kitchen and be like, "Ooh, I would have some Chateau Yquem that was around, like a little splash, whatever, you know, try to whatever was a snack." And suddenly, and I'd be like, "Nothing," you know. It was just real. It was that confining. But I will say, there is a certain thing in terms of no matter where you go, there you are. Because even here, even in my life now, even having this greatest week, possibly because, you know, breaking the Spotify record and all the stuff that happened, like I'm not too born, I'm not whatever, but having this happen at this point in my life and the book and all this stuff is so amazing. But then I don't feel like, oh, I can just walk around in my underwear with, you know, no judgment or no whatever, or walk around with, like, even talking to you guys right now, like walk around with my hair looking a mess or this and that. And that's really because of some of the things that have happened to me, where I look at it like quote unquote stardom as a fabulous thing and a goal that once achieved is like, you did it, woo! But it also comes with this level of expectation.
You always gotta be that. Yeah.
You always gotta be on. And if you're not on, if you're not on,
you fell off.
No, but even within your own home, people are like, what's the matter? Like, if I'm not walking around like, hi, because I've created this festive thing and I have to always be happy and, you know, make everybody else feel comfortable for me to just be allowed to be me. And I feel like with the book, I've gotten to a place where I can say to people who may have walked all over me previously, like, did you read the book? Because if you did, you'd see that you need to actually treat me like a human being, where like, if I'm on a video shoot and there is no water and there is no covering, you know, there is no seat. Like you, like we were just doing this, the Christmas thing with J-Hud and Ariana Grande, right? So the Apple special. And I see J-Hud team and I see the second we break, right? Because, you know, there's the union breaks and this and that. Her team is incredible. They got her seat. They got her water. They got her massage. They got her foot moment. And I'm just like, yay, J-Hud, because I love her so much. I think she's such an incredible person and she deserves that treatment more than anybody I know. But I took note of it and I was like, I've been having this struggle for years, because what happens is, and even my therapist back in the day said to me, when you smile and you're on, people don't think there's a problem. They don't think
there's anything wrong. Yeah.
You don't need to be taken care of. You don't need to be.
They don't think you're human.
I'm on camera. I'm smiling. I'm here. I'm there. And it's lit well. And it's hair and makeup and it's outfits and it's sparkly. And then then it cuts and everybody goes about their merry way. And if I don't have like a little morsel of food or just like someone helping me walk to the trailer or whatever it is, and that's a lack of management, you know, and this is, we're talking about 2001, but I'm saying this has been a pattern. And even to this day, like, I don't know, I just try to make people fit into like, fit into this space where I'm expecting them to be caretakers, but really I'm the caretaker and I always have been. So
wait then, is this book like the warning of what's to come then, Mariah? Because I mean, are you now at a point where you're understanding all these things? And so are you going into a, I don't give a fuck phase? Because I feel like now is the time to go into the I don't give a fuck phases. I don't give a fuck COVID. I don't give a fuck 2020. Like, why do you give a fuck?
Right. So here's, in the words of the immortal and ever-present Diana Ross, and I talk about this in the book, she said to me, well, we were at Top of the Pops, which you guys know what that is.
I know.
Yeah.
You know that that can make or break an artist. You might want to give them a little backstory on that. You can see everybody there.
Well, no, our readership, our fans know what Top of the Pops is.
They know what it is. But in case some of my lambs happen to listen, it was a show that could literally make or break a record in the UK and in around Europe. So you would oftentimes run into anybody from Phil Collins to, you know, Diana Ross, who I happened to run into. And she's there doing her own hair and makeup. She came into my room, you know, she's there. And this is during, this is around I'll Be There remake time. So that's like, I don't want to say numbers of years, but it's very beginning of my career, right?
90.
La, 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 la.
92, but who's counting? Okay.
Was it not? No, it was 92.
Yeah.
Yeah, around that time. I don't even, it could have been right after that, but all I know is Trey wasn't with me because Miss Ross is Trey's favorite. And I was calling him and leaving voice messages with her. But anyway, she scans the room, she's looking around the room, and she sees the hair, makeup, the this and that, the wardrobe, the managers, the lookers on, the publicists, whoever they were, and she's by herself, doing her hair, doing her makeup, walking barefoot in and out of the room. And she's like, in the most glamorous way possible. And she's like, Mariah, one day you're not going to have all these people around you. You're not going to have all these people around you. And she said, someday you're not going to want to have all these people around you. And I was like, and now I'm like, I believe that someday is here.
Good.
They're not serving a purpose of really helping you. Why are they here? We are in the age of direct messaging, of figuring out your own narrative, you know, this stuff. What is the purpose of people if they're not 100,000 trillion, what, quadrillion percent team MC and really, really care to be there? Why are you giving away money?
I wanted to ask you about one of my favorite jams of yours, Breakdown with Bone Thugs and Harmony.
Yes.
That's my shit. How did, what was that session like?
Okay, so first I was with Stevie J, and actually I had the conversation with.
Damn, I forgot Stevie J used to do music at one point.
Amazing.
We love Stevie J.
Yes, he made amazing music.
I forgot Stevie J was a legit producer.
Nah, Stevie, he was the dude. Straight up.
Was he as crazy back then as I know him now?
From the TV shows and such.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just in general. Because I don't really like keep up with that. I have my own memories of him back then.
The Stevie J I know is the Stevie J of VH1 reality shows. So I'm just trying to, was that him?
Always been there.
Also very charming.
Always very charming. I can't say.
No, she was in Sony Prison then. That wasn't happening.
I was in Sony Prison. But here's the thing. I don't think at that point that it wasn't reality shows and stuff. And it was still a grind because he was a bad boy producer, right? Mm-hmm. So he was the behind the scenes person making beats. And mm-hmm. And we ended up, so I talked to Puff about the idea of Bone Thugs and Harmony. And we were very inspired by Notorious Thugs. But mm-hmm. that was obviously more of a minor moment. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of like flipped it to have more the like a little like happy part on top of that harder beat. So, you know, we ended up knowing that they were that Crazy and Wishbone were going to be on it. And I was in the studio with Stevie J a lot. And then I ended up recording. I mean, I don't even want to tell this story. One of these days, if there's a part two, I'm going to tell the story of this. It includes brownies. It includes lots of
brownies and Busy Bone.
Say what?
Oh, brownies and Busy Bone. I'm sorry.
Brownies by myself.
Oh,
brownies
by okay. Myself. Okay.
Then, no, that session was a complete haze. Like when we were all together in the session, but I laid my vocals down first. So by the time they heard the song, it already had that. You know, it had the cake. Mm-hmm. It had that whole thing. And they were. It was clear that I was inspired by their flow and everything. So when I recorded my vocals, though, I went to Florida, and it was a whole thing with the brownies and whatever. And then I will get into greater detail at some point. But when I listened back to it, because I, you know, from my throat, it would just be like, okay, brownies. And my assistant at that time was like queen of brownies. And so she gave me the brownies. And then I'm at this restaurant in Florida after I did the whole day of vocal, like at doing my backgrounds, doing the vocals, layering them, putting it down, you know, laying out kind of like the parts I thought would be cool for the guys. And then obviously they did their thing on top of it and their own thing to it. But I listened back to it afterwards, after I got in the car, after like I got a paranoid moment, like people in the restaurant started recognizing me going, oh, Mariah Carey, can we take a picture with you? And I was like, had the brownie. So I'm like, I still felt like my high school self. And I was like, why do they want to take a picture with me? What, why, what is this? Because I just wasn't used to the whole brownies thing because I was very never doing that. And then I'm like, okay, let's get out of here. So I get in the car and I put it on and I heard how kind of like how fast I was singing. And I said to myself, what in the hell is this? Like, this is no, what did I do? I hate this. I don't know. Not that I hated it.
I love the way it came together. You wouldn't have thought on paper, but then with the execution, I was like,
So anyway, I loved it after I finished it. But when I re-listened back to it after the brownies thing, I thought I thought I had wasted a session and that was horrible. But anyway, after the recovery, which is a whole nother story, Q-Tip is involved via phone, whole thing. But, but after that, and I'm deliberately being evasive because I have to tell this story in detail at some point. But
I understand.
Anyway, then they laid there when we got SoCut 2 back at the Hit Factory in New York, a complete and total haze with those guys. But I loved working with them. And they, you know, they could hear that there was, they had inspired the whole thing. So it was, it's still one of my favorites. And I appreciate you.
Nah, I love that. Right.
Speaking of which, oh, by the way, Fonte. Q-Tip.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of which, Fonte, I listen to that Busy Bone interview like once a month.
Are you a Busy Bone fan?
Man, listen. That nigga Busy Business Bone, cuz.
Busy Bone and Michael Henderson.
He a wild boy.
are two things I have to listen to six times a year just to make it through life.
Mariah, did you ever watch BET Uncut?
Way back when, yeah.
Busy Bone had a song called Ain't Nothing Like Money in Ziploc Bags. It's one of his.
Yeah.
Ain't nothing like money in a Ziploc bag. It's a classic. So.
Yeah.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte, Fontigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew
just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
So, Mariah, I have a question. With Honey, I always wanted to know this. Okay. So, at the time when Honey was first being conceived, I was hanging with Tip a lot, and he was mad amped. Yo, I got this thing for Mariah. It's going to be incredible. And then, you know, cut to 4 months later, it kind of went through the bad boy filter.
Right.
And I always wanted to know, like, what was the conversation that transpired that turned it from the original demo that I heard, or at least the idea that he presented to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the question is, of course, you know, by 97, anything Diddy did was instant magic. So it's like, duh, of course I'm going to go, you know, go this route. I get it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, how did that transpire? Like, as far as the changing of it, because the day it came out, I called him. And you know me, again, I'm a patch fiend. I was like, yo, these are your drum patches? And he was like, nah, man. And this is a term that Tip always uses. He's like, I gave her nigger drums, man. And nah, man, they use different drum patches. So how did it come from what I heard in the demo to what we now know?
You know, that era, specifically with that song, Honey, was so much going on in my life. Don't forget, that was the first emancipation of Mimi before the actual one happened later.
Fantasy? I thought Fantasy was sort of the flag planting of...
That was me sneaking in. I snuck that in. They didn't really know who ODB was. Had they seen his album cover and knew that he made songs about gonorrhea, I don't think that would have happened.
You mean 2 years into the Wu-Tang Clan, like, no brass at Sony was like, she wants to do with some rapper, no, or whatever.
They didn't even know when I wanted to work with Jay-Z. They didn't know who he was. Like, they just weren't connected culturally, and they thought I was on some kind of trying to be cool tangent.
Nigga music.
Right.
It really was that it was a generation gap and it was a cultural gap, and it was just them feeling more comfortable with me going a different route. You know, they wanted to keep it AC. They didn't understand, but I didn't care. So, but when we go back to that Honey, specifically that record, yeah, Q-Tash, as I call him, Q-Tash, had come up with that Body Rock sample. I guess that's what.
Treacherous 3, Body Rock.
Treacherous 3. And I loved it, and I wrote the song to that loop. But then when, I guess somehow, I don't really, honestly, I think I've blocked this part out. So I don't want to say it in an accurate way, but I know that at the time, Puffy and I had done the other record together, Fantasy, and we were working on stuff. But, you know, there's a certain kind of energetically, if somebody's like...
Well, let me disclose it. It was the smarter move, because it was the smartest move to do.
I wanted to incorporate the right as that little hey DJ.
Right.
Yeah. So I wanted to incorporate that, and we had the regular, you know, the straight up loop from the Treacherous 3, and then I wanted to put that part, the Hey DJ part, in for my own reasons, which I talk about in The Meaning of Mariah Carey, the memoir. Want to say meaning and mark at the same time, but messed that up. Anyway.
Oh, DJ, you're so funny. You did that on purpose?
Yes.
Damn, savage. Nice one.
It was
and I'll say, read the book, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, because am I wrong in asking?
You didn't even get there yet. Trust me.
No. I was gonna ask one more honey question then, I'm sure you get into it in the book, but earlier on in the book, where I'm already at, I had discovered your dislike for the dance. But you just mentioned that, you know, this is also a stage in your life with honey where you felt free. So I was like, okay, so the freedom to do the choreography and stuff in the video, was that like that free feeling and just saying, fuck it, like, let's just go all out?
You know, I talk about my father's mother traumatizing me about dancing. Roy, that ancient baby, girl, let me see you dance. Like, it's a whole thing.
Yes.
You know?
It's in the book. And that's why I said that part. But you're dancing a honey. So I was like, you got it back. Like,
yeah. It didn't turn me into Janet Jackson. It's just one little choreographed moment. And it was cute. You know, I really loved that video. And that was the only time I ever had fun making a video back then. That's the first time I ever was free to make a video and kind of like express myself. And I work with Paul Hunter. And
wait, more fun than Heartbreaker?
No, but Heartbreaker is later.
In terms of fun, like...
Like, she was a Bond girl.
The first time I had fun. That was the honey video.
Oh, okay. I was about to say, I thought Heartbreaker was actually like, wow, okay. I thought that was you.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. No, but honey was... the first time there was no ever present other person on set telling me don't do that, or telling the director not to film me in a certain way or what to do.
Okay.
Yeah. It was the actual first taste of freedom that I had. Even like back in the days with the I Don't Want to Cry video, there was a male model in the video and that got squashed real quick.
That was a problem.
It was problematic. I had a whole lecture about that. Yeah.
How awkward was it to take control of the reins and decide for yourself what you wanted at that period, at least at that period of your career?
Like during Honey or, you know, the whole. So it all stemmed from being able to extract myself from that controlling situation, which was not easy, because as you know, and I don't know if you know, but like if you get into something as a kid and you allow that pattern to continue, it's very difficult to break free from that because other people just expect you to go along with it. They're used to you being compliant and you just deal with it. So especially when you're dealing with someone up at that level, which now there really isn't anyone that powerful to me, like, because the artists are in control of a lot. Everybody except me.
You are that power now.
The artists can be that powerful at this point, you know, especially if they have people to help them with that. But back then, everybody was scared of that corporate, as I call it, the corporate morgue, led by specifically one person who was uber powerful. They were all scared to death, including me. So when I got to the point that I could no longer take it, is when I decided, okay, I have to break free and I got to figure out how to do it. So if you listen to the Butterfly album and the lyrics on that album, specifically Butterfly, that was what I hoped somebody would say to me, like wild horses bridled or their spirit dies. You know, I wanted them to say, you know, I wanted them to say that, like, you know, and I truly feel your heart will lead you back to me when you're ready to land. I wanted to hear that, but I didn't hear that. So I wrote it to someone else as a lyric for that song and for that time. And it was very much what I had to gain the strength. Like if you listen to Petals from the Rainbow album, that's about like all the people that were screwed up in my life. And this is not me blaming everybody else. I'm sure I was a part of it too. I allowed it to happen. But to break free, not only from a personal relationship, but from a massive corporate structure where you have been the number one artist on that label, and you also started out as a child, really. And then also your whole personal life is surrounded by people that are slave to that system. It's really not easy to break free. And then the subsequent years when I wasn't allowed to be free, even when I was on another label, or even when I was trying to do my own thing, there was a concerted effort to kind of squash that or quash that or whatever the proper terminology is. So right. there was until the emancipation of Mimi, there, when I got with a new group of people, fortunately, you know, after all the stuff that happened, there was no freedom. There was nothing. There was a constant fight, whether I was inside the structure or having gotten out of the structure, there was a constant fight, a constant battle, and it just made me sort of implode, and it really, really screwed me up. But what can you do? Here I am, and it's great. Hallelujah. Thank God. And, yeah. You know,
man.
I'm not going to dwell on that stuff, but I talked about it in the book because I wanted to actually, when people years from now tell my story, hopefully that happens, they're going to have to use that book as a template. Like, mm-hmm. This is my actual story. And I look at a lot of people that I admired who didn't get a chance to do that. They may have told their stories through their music, and people may interpret their stories. And I know some True. People, Amir, like to have everybody else's input and their perspective. But what I wanted was to tell my actual story, which doesn't begin with Mariah Carey put out Vision of Love in 1990. No, it doesn't begin with that. It begins with I'm coloring in the wrong crayon with a brown crayon from my father, so they all freak out on me. It begins with, like, I don't understand my hair because I'm, you know, it begins with all these identity issues, these issues of race, these struggles. And then it goes, you know, it goes to the issues of control, and people, you know, always wanted to have control. And even though that's not my song, but I'm just saying, there's a thing where this is a constant theme. And it's also like just being a woman in a male dominated industry, and then a woman of color with all this ambiguity and people deciding how they're going to market me and all of that shit. So
what were some of the things you mentioned earlier that, you know, you would hear things that they, you know, that people would say that, you know, you wouldn't be privy to if you had darker skin or whatever. So like, what was some of the stuff, and you don't have to attribute it to anyone, but just like, what's some of the stuff you would hear like white people say around you that, you know what I'm saying, that you knew was, that wasn't right. Whether about your music or whatever, you know what I'm saying?
I'm going all the way back to childhood. I'm going to kindergarten. I'm going to, like I said, coloring with the brown crayon and having the teachers come over and go, ha, why did you use that crayon? Like, I used a green crayon, but because they just didn't know. So, and having the entire class stare at me, basically I was humiliated. And that's the first time I realized I was different from anybody else, because they had only seen my white mother coming and going, you know. But my parents also were divorced. I'm quite sure if I had had I would have had a different experience with a family that was married. If they were going to be a mixed family, they started out in Brooklyn Heights. If they had just stayed married, stayed in Brooklyn Heights, like where diversity is more, they're used to diversity a bit more than like feeling like, oh, let me, you know, both of them, I feel like both my parents, mainly my father was like, I want my kids to have a better life. So he thought moving, you know, like he thought doing
baby
that.
Baby boomers.
Yeah, they thought like that was, he thought that was gonna make it better, but really, it made it worse. I talk about, like, I don't know my ex-siblings' experiences. I know what I've heard. I'm sure it was horrible for them, and I feel bad for them. But they thought it was easier for me. And in actuality, it was probably, I won't say it's worse or better, because I can't speak for anybody's experience but my own. But I know that, so I tried to deal with that selflessly in the book. You know, I tried to give that sort of like, you know, look, they put me through hell. And I, in my opinion, I'm not going to say who's what or who did what. But
right. The
point is, I heard a lot of stuff. Like, I have this song called Close My Eyes, which is one of my fans' favorite. And it's from one of my favorites from the Butterfly album. And it goes, I was a wayward child with the weight of the world that I held deep inside. Life was a winding road, and I learned many things little ones should have known, but I closed my eyes, steadied my feet on the ground, raised my head to the sky, and the time rolled by. Still, I feel like that child as I look at the moon. Maybe I grew up a little too soon. Meaning, I was in this fucked up place, and I had to grow up on my own and figure it out by myself. You know, so here I am. There is no woe is me. This is just my story. It's unique to me. And other people that have similar experiences, I guess, will understand it. Or hopefully it will empower other people to feel like they're important enough, they're worthy enough to exist. Because I actually didn't feel worthy. But I did have, thank God, a spark of hope to know that one day I would get out of the situation I was born into. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask you, Mariah, do you think that in your marriage to Tommy and what you refer to as the kind of Sony prison years, do you think that played a role in you marrying Nick and choosing someone that was at least on paper, like very different? You know what I'm saying?
Very different from the first marriage?
From the first marriage, I mean, yeah. On paper. I mean, I don't know what the marriage was like, but on paper, it appeared that way.
Yeah. I mean, look, the power dynamic in the first, like, I laugh at it now because I would have two marriages, whatever. I'm like, you mean my first ex-husband? My second?
Hey, it's all good. I'm on my second time around, too. Don't even trip. It's all good.
And I keep him on the second
five.
Time.
No, I'm playing.
I would just like to be invited. Sorry. Go ahead.
Life is coming.
No, honestly, it was fun. It was great fun, but it was just one of those things. No, it was great. Nick and I had fun, and it was like, let's just be kids and have a good time and whatever. And the bottom line is we co-parent now, and we have two kids that I love that make my life a better thing, that give me unconditional love, I hope. And yes. It's a totally different experience. It's a completely different experience. But yes, I don't think I would have ever done. How could I do? There could never be a situation where I would be that vulnerable to being fully under somebody else's control like that ever again.
That's good. Everybody don't learn their lessons. Everybody don't learn their lessons. So that's good.
No, for real.
But I'm saying it's honestly impossible. How can you be? You can't recreate like, okay, there's going to be this mogul.
Oh, yeah, right.
Kid that has nothing, that has $1 a week, a day, and then they're going to help, you know, give you your record deal, but you're actually going to write all these songs, produce them, do this and that, and you're going to make them money and their corporation money, but still they're going
to
control
and still you. Have to split the damn bills.
Right.
That was me. I blame myself.
Yeah. She wanted ownership.
So, Mariah. Yes. Okay, so now that the book is out and has done well, obviously, I mean, I would think the next logical step, and, you know, when I finished the book, I was like, okay, I already feel like Lee Daniels is already speaking to her, like,
ooh, that's a good one.
Well, but then I thought about it, and it just hit me that not enough Bruja was made on your
Precious
performance and
yes.
Precious. And
but it circles back
recapping,
to who she is. Yes, yes.
And I'm recapping your videos for this episode. Mm. And again, also recapping your narration of the audiobook. Yeah, are you ever going to get on? Are you properly going to get on the acting horse again? Has Glitter made you gun shy? Or like
what? Because Precious came so much after.
I know, but I'm just saying that is I feel like that's an area that you really, really should explore because your comic timing is on point with the book and the shorts you did with Funny or Die were also funny, you know, like engaging. Do you want to explore the acting world and immerse yourself in it for real? This go around, or are you just fine with like, okay, I tried it once and I'm fine?
Well, here's the thing. So when I first met the Daniels, it was post Glitter, and he was actually, and I had done this movie called Wise Girls with Mira Sorvino. That was an independent movie. Yeah. So that could have been a great movie. I don't know about great, but it was supposed to have been narrated by her character. A lot of the scenes were kind of like added at the end, but it's like the land of independent filmmaking. So my original goal was always start, I always wanted to act, but my original, like if I could create, like, here is my path, it was to start with independent projects, to do things that were character driven, to work with great directors, et cetera, et cetera. But that, the whole acting thing was completely a non-starter for the corporate morgue, one person mainly.
Okay.
And so it wasn't even allowed to get, and I talk about it in the book, so this is no secret. I'm actually being more cagey, whatever, about it than I was in the book, but it wasn't allowed. It just wasn't allowed. So my path of, like, let me do these gritty independent projects was just, it wasn't even that it wasn't encouraged. It was blocked. It was not allowed. So in developing Glitter, what happened was they very much whitewashed it, quite literally, you know, the studio, this, the, that. And then by the end of it, there was so much, oh, it just all was so incestuous. The label ended up with this and with that, and then having, like, left, you know, that whole situation, the, it just became like, there was no script. It was all over the place. And it wasn't right. And then it came out on, you know, September 11th, 2001. So what are you going to do? But then meeting, yeah. But then, like, you know, Wise Girls and Lee had seen that. And then he was like, I love your acting. Like, you should be encouraged. So we worked on a couple other projects together. And then we did Precious, which he called me the day before. And was like, hey, you want to do this? I had read Push by Sapphire, which I don't know if you guys read that, but I read it.
Yeah, we know it.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, my friend Ron had given it to me. We're on the beach in Ibiza. I read it twice. So when I knew that Lee was doing the movie, I was like, wow, did I think there was a part for me in the movie? No, not really. Who knew his take on it? But I'm so happy that I did, because he's a visionary. He's a great director. Mm-hmm. And he understood what it took to put me in a role and have it be not, quote, Mariah Carey. So we did that, and working with Monique and Gabby was just like, really being in it. And I loved it. But yeah.
Can I ask you, though, because now through reading the book and knowing your life and the characters that have come in and out of your life and the situations that you've been in, and knowing that character in Precious, which you blew me away, like, no bullshit. Mm-hmm. Tell us, was it something personal that you were drawing from? And what was the direction from Lee to you about that character?
Lee's direction is pretty much always this: do nothing, do nothing,
okay.
Do nothing. I'm laughing when I say that, because of course he gives more direction. But let's say after he gives you his direction, he's like, okay, do nothing. And I'm like, how do I do nothing? But I have to say, on that particular shoot, we really only did like 3 or 4 takes of that. And it was so powerful because I had worked with a woman named Karen Giordano, who's a really close friend of mine and who is an acting coach, but also a director. And Lee was working with her on Precious, mainly with the girls in the scene at Teach One. And so they were, it was all improv. He loves improvisation. So it, you know, she was like, oh my gosh, this is an incredible thing energetically that's happening with this movie. And she was so excited about it. And then the last minute he called me and Karen just put together kind of like a backstory for the character really quick. And Lee's main concern was, you know, he had a prosthetic nose made for me, which we didn't even end up using, but putting it on and taking it off because my skin is so sensitive made it enlarged anyway. So that was great for him, because that was his main concern. He thought he caught me putting on makeup. He was like, what are you doing? I'm like, but you know, everybody had their makeup and hair and their shirts, but his main thing, and I loved it because a lot of people, when the movie first came out, they didn't even recognize me because there was an accent, there was a whole different look. So to answer the initial question, do I want to do more of it? I don't know. It would depend on the director. It would depend on the role. Honestly, I don't want to do it just for the sake of doing it. I want to do it for the creative experience, but I do know that, like, I am high maintenance. me as Mariah Carey, I'm a freaking high maintenance.
No.
No, I am. And I've always said it. I said it in some interview. I think it was with The Guardian. I'm like, yeah, I've always been high maintenance. I just didn't have people to facilitate the maintenance. So
even honestly, as an actress, you're high maintenance? Like how, Mariah the singer, one thing. But when you go to set and stuff, it's still the same expected. No. Oh, okay.
For that role, absolutely not. Like, and okay. And Lee wouldn't have tolerated it.
I know that's right.
Yeah, I just have to get it's if that's the role and that's what we're doing, then that's what we're doing. Yeah. But if I want to do another project, I love behind the scenes. I love executive producing. I love writing. You know, I love all of that stuff. And yes, I want to act more and I want to do things that are fun. Speaking of which, Amir, how was your experience as Curly?
This is not my interview.
I'm interviewing you right now. That's why I'm
hiding. Get out.
I just want to know because I loved that. I loved that moment of you being able to be a part of that without, you know, I in my mind, like I would love to do some animation. I would love to do some more of that type of stuff. You know,
oh, this is for Soul. Oh, I haven't watched it yet. So yeah. How was your experience?
I watched it five times.
It was a dream come true. Yes. It was historical. I love it. This is not my interview. You're not getting off.
Right.
Okay.
No, but I really think, I mean, there's some people that have to ease into acting and do a lot of prep work and, you know, get with their coaches and all that. But you have a really natural, believable acting ability that I think that you should explore more. Like your timing is great. Which I think comes from singing or whatever, but I think you should explore that. So, you know,
I really do want
my
to.
Two cents.
No, and I, by the way, that's a lot of 2 cents coming from you because of taste level and everything that you know, just knowledge wise. I'm just like the mistake I made with Glitter, which maybe it wasn't a mistake. It was probably supposed to happen that way. You have to have a huge fall for people to care about you again, I guess. I don't know. Maybe it is just me. That's just how they did me. But, you know, after that experience, I realized you have to work with somebody, a top tier person, to bring out the best in you. It's like anything. It's like collaborating on a song. Like you can lead the way. You could be the one doing most of it. But at least, you know, when you have someone where it's just, the scales are more balanced, I feel like that's a different experience. You know what I mean?
Maybe Lee's your person.
Yeah.
I'm just putting it out there.
Person, I believe that he is, and we've been talking about, you know, some ideas. It's just a big to put this memoir and adapt it into like where we're talking about taking it. It's going to be interesting.
It's a series. It's a series.
Yeah,
it can't even be a
series.
Yeah, all day. Fonte, just like the early years.
It is. Yeah. It can easily be an Amazon 8-part season. Like a it's a no-brainer.
We've been talking about that, and that's not necessarily Amazon, but I'm saying that's the thing. Like, and what to the earlier discussion about why or writing the book or what, I don't think anybody said why, but just to answer the thing about like how this whole thing happened. I said initially I wanted to emancipate my little girl self, like little Mariah. That was the goal because nobody knew her. She wasn't famous. I know I'm speaking about myself in the third person, but really I feel like my little
self,
it's like a different person because she wasn't famous. Nobody knew she was. She's this poor little, you know, for what a lot of people thought of as like this mongrel type of a person. And so, you know, a sad kid, but with a lot of hope and ambition and stuff. But again, the film adaptation, whether it's a series or whatever, has to bring that girl to life. Do you know what I mean? Has to show people.
Right.
It's not just this princess thing that you're seeing. There's a lot of real stuff. Yeah, that happened.
Hey, is there a person that you've longed to work with that you have not worked with yet? Or have you checked off everything off on your bucket list?
My bucket list? No. I don't really have a bucket list. I mean, yeah.
Yeah,
people on it. You're on it. Many people are on it. Like, I'm just not.
Oh,
not-
you're saying that to all the curlies. No, but I mean, in terms of, I mean, because, and I don't consider this, you know, the victory lap of All I Want Is You as a, I don't consider that a curtain call or a swan song or anything, but right. Like, is there anything that you haven't done that you wanted to do? Wait a minute.
What?
I forgot.
Whoa.
I totally forgot. Dude, we have to talk about it. Chick.
Thank you. I totally forgot too.
I forgot. Okay, so you guys don't know. I don't even know if I should reveal this much. Basically, in the shortest way possible, Mariah pulled a Charlie XCX Iconopop move. She prior, made a.
I think it was prior to her.
Oh yeah, I know, but I'm trying to put in contemporary term. Yeah. She basically made a dummy album or a side project, a Chris Gaines, if you will.
I was about to say thank you. That's
Chris Gaines. Yeah.
I was trying to go
me.
Through every.
Thank you.
I was trying to go through every.
Give me Chris
Wait,
Gaines.
You don't
I
know that Iconopop is Charlie XCX's secret.
I don't
secret.
Even know.
I didn't even know who Charlie XCX was.
Damn, y'all.
You made me feel stupid yesterday, Amir.
Look, I work at the Tonight Show. I have to know who every Gen Z person. Yes,
but
there's
I
know a song. Chris
Gaines, no, I get it, but you're the only one that
was working
the song.
Show.
I don't care. I love it.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah, I know. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So basically, Charlie XCX didn't want to ruin her credibility, so she Milli Vanilli'd that song out of these two model girls named. Iconopop, but it kind of backfired because that song became super big.
That shit popped.
Right. Yo. Even though Charlie XCX is, even though she's a name in her own right, she uses the Iconopop thing as sort of an excuse to.
It was like Prince in the time.
Right. But we knew that Prince was Madhouse, and we knew that Prince was the time, and we knew that Prince was Sheila E., and we knew that Prince was.
Now that Prince
Charlie XCX things was totally, that was totally
Wait,
anonymous.
Did we just
no
lose
one knew
Mariah?
That she was my.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
John Ames, I apologize.
Okay, so let me rephrase the question. The question was that the general public doesn't know that you've made the secret album called Chick.
Yes.
In which you kind of let loose and made a very convincing alternative rock record. What year did you record Chick?
The same year that I was doing the Daydream album. So
95?
Yeah. Always Be My Baby and
okay.
And Sweet Day and all that. Yeah.
Can I find it?
No. I wanted to, I didn't know how close to the chest you were with it. So I didn't share it with them.
But can we play one song? Can we play like a part of a song? Can I give my own little disclaimer about this? I mean,
yes, do what you need to do.
Okay, when the credits roll, we'll play it at the end of the show.
Okay, but we don't have to play the whole song, but I just want to say what really was going on. Unless you want to ask me about what was really going on.
I do want to ask. So, okay, so to set it up, you made kind of your version of Seattle grunge, nihilistic alt rock record, you know. What was on your mind? Like, what made this happen? It's one thing to do one song, but you made a whole ass album out of it.
Mm-hmm. I was like observing the landscape at that time as a 20 whatever year old woman making music and having success in a very kind of specific couple genres, and looking at other people that seem to be able to just be so, as me and my friend call it, so fucking carefree. Like, how are you so carefree that you can do whatever you want, you can wear whatever you want? Now I guess everybody can, but at the time it was just like, oh, I can, they could just wear like a dirty slip and socks and you know what I mean? Like in that grunge moment, I was jealous, I have to say. I was like, and not that my image was perfect, and now if I could go back and unblow out my bangs, I would definitely do that and have different styling and stuff like that. But, you know, so I was looking at it and I was like, because I did grow up listening to like Blondie and not exclusively Blondie. I just mean, if there were other genres, it would be like, you know, Pat Benatar and Blondie and then whatever rock groups. And then, you know, I was a child of the radio, so I listened to all different things, rock music, whatever, you know, mainly obviously like R&B and soul music and gospel and whatever. But then there was also this like heavy rock quotient that was around, like where I was growing up. So
yeah, and Long Island.
Yes. But there was everything. There was obviously, there was hip hop, there was this, there was, you know, whatever it was, but there was a very strong thread of that happening, right? So when I saw the whole grunge thing going on, I was looking at it like, oh my gosh, they just say whatever they want. They say anything that they want and they get away with it. So I would be like working on, let's, for example, say like One Sweet Day, like finishing up mixes or whatever we were doing, overdubs, and the band would be there, like my band from the little touring that I did. So I just one night was like, I was just singing stuff and making fun of, like, not making fun of, but just like doing my own little impersonations as I do. And then I said to Gary, who was my guitar player at the time, I was like, can you just play? Because he's sitting there with his guitar and he was doing overdubs on something totally different. I'm like, can you just play it? Like, whatever. So he starts playing it and that's the song called Joe. Mm-hmm. That's not the one I would love to hear. I would love to hear Hermit. But so then I just started writing stuff down, like anything I wanted to say. Finished it in like 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And it was for laughs. But then as the projects that, like, every night when we would be working, and actually, like, the corporate people were on a trip to Italy at that time. So they weren't there to stop the flow. So
Wait, whoa. You allowed Sony Brass in your sessions?
I had to allow one brass member who was like
Sony Prison.
The brass.
The maker of brass.
Right. Right.
I forgot. I totally forgot. Okay.
Nobody else. And he wouldn't allow anybody else in there. But never during my vocals was anybody allowed in there. Still not. But I'm saying, like, they would be, if they were around, it would be like a swift, let me pick you up at 7 and we'll go to dinner at La Scala or wherever. And then I had to be in that wifey world of corporate people. So it took me from, like, a complete creative head to here I am, like, I think such and such, you know. We talk about it in the chapter called Thanksgiving is Canceled. That's kind of one of my favorite things. And then this year, Thanksgiving really was canceled. So it was ironic. But anyway, so I just ended up every night, like, recording something new and writing something new. And it was just as a creative outlet. But then then we actually mixed it and did it and recorded it, you know, recorded it, mixed it, mastered it.
Would you do it in another room? Because I'm in 95. I don't think it's that. I mean, now I could tell Steve, all right, put this other song up real quick, and he can, you know, sort of with technology and a snap do that. But 95, you're working with reels and that sort of thing. So
there's still Pro Tools at that time.
So you would just make them erase the board and then put up your reels so you could work on your, like, weren't they scared? Like, well, what if Tommy comes in here and sees what we're doing? Or
no, because at a certain point I told him, he knew about it, but it wasn't like we had separate reels. Like, I've just found them that say the name of the group. So after we, you know, the engineer just started rolling. Like, you know, I mean, at that time, it wasn't like we had to worry about, oh my gosh, a new roll of tape. Like, you know, we knew what we had to do. And, you know, most
y'all was printing money. Shit.
Yeah. So we,
y'all was doing numbers.
Yes. And we want to do that again, but it's impossible because with streaming, we know that the artist makes less than, you know, what percentage of a penny do the artists make? They basically, like
0.001, yeah.
Yeah,
0.006, something crazy, yeah.
Very small. I failed remedial math, so I don't know how to do that math, but I just know if you did 130 million streams in a week, you should make at least a dollar off that, and you don't.
Right.
This was a labor of love, and this was just me being like, let me just do this. Write it down, whatever. The musicians loved it because it was a total departure from what we were doing, and they got to be free. They got to just, we were all kind of in an act. Like, it was an act. It was a, whatever you call it. It was, what did you call it? An alt rock.
Alternative rock.
But what's the future of it? Will folks ever know? Will it all be like a red herring?
I feel like if you officially release it, though, the magic ends. Like, that's the thing. Prince's The Black Album was so legendary when it was like a secret.
Just one song. Just do one song.
And then that shit came out and niggas was like,
and it came out and
there
was like, the magic's over.
Yeah.
I mean,
to your point about it being, what did you say when you first brought it out? Oh, doing one song versus doing an album. Like, yeah,
you did a whole album.
And I also, did you see the artwork? I did the artwork myself.
The copyrights and everything. Yes.
Oh, that's not nice, y'all. This is mean.
No, but at the end of the day, I brought my friend Clarissa, and I said, you know what? Because certain people were like, oh, you can't put this out there. I also changed the lyrics. So a lot of it was a little bit more with the profanity and stuff. Because he made me change it and put somebody
on
it. I know, but I have the reels at this point. So at some point, I'm going to put out my own version, but I don't have the board mixes. All I have are, like, all the separate tracks, like 10 guitar tracks and, you know, all of this.
Wow.
I've got to get back into it.
Mariah, do you know what Record Store Day is?
No, man.
Okay.
You clean the fuck up.
I'm going to tell you how to do this, son. So Record Store Day... it happens in the second Saturday of April. and they made a second one for Black Friday in November. But what it is sort of sound nerd, audio nerds like us, people, I mean, this is the equivalent of like new Jordans coming out. So some people will sleep outside of what was formerly known as Amoeba Records in L.A. I mean, it moved to another location. It didn't shut down. But basically, Record Store Day is a day that pretty much everyone lives for in April to buy like rare, you know, somebody, Jack
rare
White
and
will
exclusive
print up,
joints. Yeah.
Yeah, exclusive. So Jack White will print up like 5,000 copies of some particular like song that, you know, it's either a 45 or maybe like a 10 inch or whatever, but they do it in small numbers, so it's almost like art. And usually, you know, somebody will wind up paying like a gazillion dollars on eBay for it or something like that. I think you should make 5,000 copies of the record that you intended to make and just secretly release it on Record Store Day and just let the legend of Chick go out live. That way.
I agree. And you know what? I think it should be that. And also the artwork should be, I should do the original artwork.
Yeah.
And Sonic, people don't even know. I literally wrote, okay, so it's a dead roach. That's the cover. Then it's a lipstick written Chick on top of it that I wrote in my handwriting.
Right.
The title is Some Ugly Daughter. That's the title of the album.
Mm-hmm.
And then the back of the album is a crushed makeup, thing of makeup, like eyeshadows or pink, blue pastels. And then I just did like with a fork at the Hit Factory. I just like did and then took a picture of it and then wrote all the song titles on the back. And then the CD itself, I did like kissed it. Like it's a whole thing. Like the physical CD is amazing. And somebody gave me a copy because I didn't have one. Like, you know, it was for laughs. And then like I did it and then they ruined it by making, not that they ruined it. I love Clarissa. She did a great job singing on top of it. And we worked on a couple songs. I didn't send you those two. I did the original album as intended. That's what I sent to you, Amir. But anyway, so it became like a thing where it wasn't allowed to be me anymore. What I was going to do is back then release it, do a total different character visually, and then hopefully have a hit with one of the songs and then reveal that it was me and be like, huh? Because at that time it was very much like if you were quote unquote popular on the pop charts, you could not have critical acclaim. They just didn't give it to you. They just didn't care. It was just like, ah, da, da, da. You know, we like this artsy person. We like this edgy person, whatever. And so it was what it was. But at this point, I do think Chick needs to have its own thing. And I actually been having conversations with someone I'm not going to name about doing like another version of Chick, some of those songs, and writing a couple new ones. And I'm asking you now if you will write those with me or at least like explore it, because she's a young 16-year-old girl who is very famous and she's perfect for this. And we've already had conversations about it. And I'm planning on like hopefully working on it this coming
month. Yo, Billie Eilish?
No.
No. Okay. We know that. But
he's guessing already.
I'm like, yo.
I'm
all right. But why, right? Why actually? Amir, why you bullshitting?
Actually,
yeah.
Why you bullshitting?
I know who you chose, Mariah, but on the real, yeah, Fonte's right.
We talked about it. She and I. She's an actress, but she wants to sing as well. And
it's a good look. It'll work with her too. It'll work.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I know. It'll work.
Okay.
Nah, I think you should definitely do that, Mariah, because we've been talking now for like 3 hours. Out of everything that you've talked about, this is the most excited you've sounded about anything.
Well, because I can talk about my own top stories all the live long day, but this is something that got squashed, and it's something that's fun. Like, it's not, you don't sit there and pick I'm not picking it apart.
And this sounds like you. I mean, it's just from, you know, just us sitting here having this conversation, you know, this sounds like the thing that most feels like it most represents you. You know what I'm saying? Like, seems like true to who you are.
I mean,
you
know? My music represents me. I'm not saying it doesn't. It represents a silly side of me that was, at a time, really needed an outlet. It was a musical departure, but it was for laughs, which is how I get through most things, is just making jokes and getting through it. So it was like combining two kind of, two escape mechanisms, you know, it was music and it was fun and it was me like just writing for laughs. That's why I want to play that song Hermit, because, but the funny thing is, even my daughter Monroe was like, so she heard it. She heard the song Malibu, and then she heard the rest of the songs, and she just started singing the one Hermit that goes, I am in water. Like, it's in the accent, this whole thing. She heard it. She goes, she's nine. She goes, Mommy, can you send me the Chicks album?
And see? I'm like,
oh. Yo.
Amir said, you promise now. I'm just going to say.
It sounds amazing. This record sounds amazing.
Yes. Like, you have to put this out. Play the song on
we will
this
play
episode.
It on the fade. We'll play he Hermit on the fade. Yes,
okay.
We
are not editing this out. All right.
But wait, Mariah.
I go this long without having music in the background, to be honest with you, because
we're on Zoom. If this were the real format of the show, girl, then I would have the ability to add music, but because of COVID and Zoom.
Oh, Mariah roll call. That would have been.
I know. I miss roll call.
Yeah, I know. I was like, oh, I'm glad I don't have to be put under that pressure with the roll call.
I miss roll call. But wait, can I ask something though? So basically, I'm gathering is what was freeing for you, and what elated you was sort of the carefreeness of creating music, kind of without a care and being honest and just putting it all out there.
But for I would have to get through it without laughing some of the time. Like, that was part of it.
Yeah, but humor. Here's the thing, though, and even though I'm. Even though I'm clamoring on the mountaintops about your acting, it's really your sense of humor, which I never knew you had. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
No one cared, like my fans knew, but if no one cares to know, I can't expect people to know. You know, like
Let me rephrase it. No,
Everybody didn't get the joke.
I'm not on the outside looking in. I've been to many a Mariah concert. I know you have a sense of humor, but it's relaxed timing. But what I feel that the white elephant question I want to ask is, like, would you ever try to create an album in that vein, not under the guise of like, well, I'm going to do a music genre that's totally the opposite of what I'm known for. Would you not ever try to exercise that sort of freedom in your actual Mariah career? Not like, hey, guys, let's have some fun and do an alternative rock record. Or let's do a samba record. Or let's do a Afrobeat record. Like,
I never even said, and I hear what you're saying, but I never said to them, let's do an alternative rock album. I was just in that era, when all that stuff was huge, and they happened to be very talented musicians in the room who could easily pull that off. And actually, sometimes we deliberately did stuff not perfectly.
You had to play down,
But it was fun. Like, it was just fun. So to answer your question, I would love to do, honestly, I have another concept that I want to talk to you about that we also kind of touched on. And I would do whatever. Like, no, I don't want to ever. I'm not inspired to do a samba record. I'm not inspired to do, like, whatever. I mean, I would totally do something that's not my genre. Here was the great thing about that moment. It was just free. It was just free. And I know people experience that without having an alternative ego or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, most people experience that. I'm sure when you're making music, most of the time, it's out of joy. Like, I don't know. I can't be sure about anything, but...
Right.
It's not constantly nitpicking yourself or putting yourself like, oh, I hate that. Let me do it again. Like, that's how I am.
Is it easy for you to create and craft songs without having to also be your judge and jury and executioner? Like, you know, to the point where, okay, I have to make sure that this is notes correct. Like, I'm a guy that loves I love mistakes. I love imperfection. You know, mm-hmm. I love wrong notes. I love bending notes. I love, you know, I love imperfection so much. Like, but could you, do you think you could ever, like, let your
allow yourself down to a be that bit free? Or,
yeah.
And put it out or just do it for laughs?
Nah, put it out as, not as like a side silly project, put it out as Mariah Carey.
It depends on what it was. I would have to be in the room and feel what we're doing. Like, what's the inspiration? What are we doing? Like, where are we coming from? Like, yeah, we could, I would all day experiment all day. I'm not going to commit to prior to, oh yeah, this is definitely coming out. Like, right. I would have right. to love it, live with it, you know?
Okay.
What's your thought, Amir?
Well, this is the thing. I'm glad we finally did this interview so we can have normal conversations, because you and I have been cat and mousing for so long because I wanted our initial conversation to be this podcast so I could not nerd out on you in real life. So,
oh, what? Y'all been talking this whole time. What are you talking about?
Yeah, but I mean, like, I've been purposely holding back because usually when I start friendships, it starts in the guise of journalists, and that makes people uncomfortable. Like, hey, by the way, when you did that to court and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like, I wanted to get that out the way here.
What brought y'all two together anyway?
The book, really.
The book? I love the book.
That's right. Oh, there's him hitting you up about the food, the Ritz crackers.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. The book strung me in. So yeah, now a friendship can form.
That's dope.
No, it really meant so much to me because, you know, you are an incredible writer and your level of knowledge is just, you know, as we all know,
off the charts. So,
no, but it's true. But then wait, the whole thing with the food in the book, it's a thing. Like, yeah. it really is a thing.
How'd the linguine turn out?
It was one of the best years, I gotta say. It was definitely
right, one of these Christmases. I gotta try this linguine.
It's like daddy's linguine. Your dad's yes. clam sauce.
Mm-hmm. She only does it for Christmas.
That's the part I texted Amir about. I was like, I want some of that.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I tell you, it's really good. And I didn't even know the secret ingredient were the onions. Because for years, I was like, why can't I find any restaurant that makes my dad, like, makes better than my dad's linguine with white clam sauce? Like, these Italian restaurants, even in Italy, they don't do it as well. I was like, what is it that, you know, a black man from Harlem made?
You just said it. You just said it.
There it is. But the truth is, but they didn't tell, like, he didn't, I never had the recipe. And then, like, the year before he died, he gave me the actual recipe and wrote it down for me. And then I was the best gift he ever gave me. And then I realized what I was doing wrong. I never saw him put onions in it as a kid, but they liquefy in the pan. That's the secret. So every year now I just do it. And it's this Christmas Eve, it's every Christmas Eve. I just decided I'm not doing Christmas dinner with the traditional nonsense. It was a mess this year. No offense to the chef or whatever, but the turkey was dry and everything. I couldn't take it.
You cooked no offense this entire, to the chef. You cooked last Christmas? You cooked?
Last Christmas night. Oh,
we're in January now, so.
Yes. I cooked my dad's recipe for linguine white clam sauce Christmas Eve, and then I did Christmas dinner, but I supervised it, but not well enough. See, it's a constant theme. You have to micromanage everything, and I'm so tired of it. Anybody listening to this podcast, please DM me. If you're not a psycho and you just want a job as, like, a facilitator, you feel that you really want to be in on a level where we're going to get to a very, very different level starting this year.
Don't do it's that. One of,
wait, you're talking about list. Food?
No. I'm talking about administrative assistant. I'm talking about executive
Mariah
assistant.
Mariah is hiring, and you do not Mariah want that trouble.
Mariah Carey's hiring.
I'm talking about staff. We can't even organize this freaking podcast without all this crap happening.
This came off without a hitch. Mariah, no, I appreciate you. You truly let your guard down. I don't think you've ever given a 3-hour interview before.
I haven't.
So I feel honored and I feel the love that you trusted me so much to do this for me.
Yes.
Even when you agreed, I was like, oh man, this might be like Michelle Obama, like 25 minutes.
Oh my God.
No, I'm enjoying hanging out with you guys and having a splash and stuff. And thank you for having me and everything else.
Mariah, we thank you so much for doing this for us.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the music. Thank you so much.
Everything.
Yes.
For caring. So,
yes.
This year, guys, don't forget anybody. Year. I'm hiring.
Call me. My God.
I'm going to take that off the podcast. You have your DMs.
I'm serious.
Jesus Christ.
If I'm here for 3 hours, you need to make sure to get me somebody for real. There's no offense to anybody.
I got you.
He can help you. Yeah, he can help you with that.
I got you. I'm an expert in this area. I got
Mariah,
you.
Mariah, thank you for sharing truth. It was a beautiful story. I mean, I know a lot of it was hard, but thank you for sharing. It was really brave.
Yes, we appreciate it. All right. On behalf of Laia, Sugar Steve, Fontigolo, and Unpaid Bill, you missed one, Unpaid Bill. Your fault, bro.
Love you guys. Thank you. And
we love you back.
Yeah. All right.
Cheers, darling.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye. Cheers.
Peace.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I know we made a promise. This is Hermit from the Lost Mariah Carey Chick Project, which is actually kind of dope. I dig it. Hope you do too. All right. See y'all.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS and let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. All right? Peace.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.